Okay, let's get going.
Okay, hipsters, flipsters, hackers, crackers, female popping daddies, and monkeys and maybes, I'm Matt. Welcome to GoreBot. Okay, having a little problems here getting things to talk to the projectors, so we're just going to flip the order, and we're going to start with Mike Kaniowski. A couple announcements to start off with. First, thank you to Sharon for organizing everything. Thank you to Monica at Boca for hosting us. Be very nice to your bartenders and everything. Start forgetting anything here.
Stick around
afterwards for drinking and open work. So our first speaker, we're flipping the schedule, is Mike Kaniowski, who's going to be talking about the coming age of magic. Mike has a distinguished pedigree, including that as a power tool drag racer. I remember one of his entries was based on a kitchen power canister, is that right?
Yeah.
And it didn't win on speed, but it sure got some points for style. So I'm going to turn it over to Mike, and we are ready to dork.
Thank you. I'm going to be juggling three things. I have a laptop, a microphone, and my notes. So, excuse me. I'm good. There's some confusion because I'm not going to read that. All right. So, let me.
Does this help?
Yeah, maybe.
Okay. Oh, no. The precious cable. Yeah.
Wait.
Oh, wait.
No. Hold on.
Let me resume.
I'm going to put this down instead of a bump. All right. We're going to try this again.
There.
Right. All right. So let me start off by telling you a little bit more about who I am. I wrote this book that's about user experience design and research. I co-founded a company that specialized in that called Adaptive Path. I recently co-founded another company that's called Theum that specializes in user experience design for ubiquitous computing. I'm a designer and writer and some other stuff. One of the other things that I'm really interested in is the way that the expressive possibilities of technology. Here are some projects that I've done that relate to that. This is a project I did with Jim Mason called The Stock Puppets. This is a project I did with Elizabeth Goodman called Three Dreams. This is a generative subsonic bass project I did called Bass Ghost. This is a Roomba hacking project I did with Todd Kurth. And this is a thing that I curated at the Isaiah, a cafe of augmented objects I curated at Isaiah 01 earlier this year. Today, I would like to talk about magic. Not really this kind of magic either. What I want to talk about is magic as a metaphor for the user experience design of ubiquitous computing. But before I do that, let me actually talk about, let me actually do two things. Let me get a chair so that I can do this a little bit better. And let me talk about, yeah.
Could you hold the microphone a little closer, please?
Sure. I can do that also. Let me see if I can. Some of the cables. All right. Mostly, I just need the light from my laptop to light my notes. So before I get into that, so the thing that I want to talk about today is, like I was saying, magic as a metaphor for user experience design and ubiquitous computing. And before I get into that, I want to talk about the previous metaphor for the design of desktop computers, which was, as we all know, the desktop metaphor. It started out in the early 80s like this, somebody saw one of these, invented this, it became popularized with that, and we ended up with this. So I'm sure that you're all familiar with the evolution of the desktop metaphor, but there you go, 15 seconds. This image is roughly from the mid-90s. It's actually an amalgam of a Mac and a PC. I actually stole it. I didn't do it, but it seems appropriate now. In the mid-90s, something else other than Windows 95 happened. And I'm not talking about the web. So that's certainly part of it. I'm talking about the low-power CPUs. And specifically, low-power CPUs coupled with the lithium-ion batteries and mature communication standards. These allowed for the creation of a new class of computational device, portable devices, and devices that weren't tied to the desk and didn't necessarily have a keyboard. Apple made one of the Newton, Palm made the Pilot, and we all know what happened to both the trajectories of those. But what's interesting about both of them is despite the physical differences, the core interaction design paradigm all of them were using was at its heart, the desktop. And I want to talk about a device that's from that same era that took this to an interesting place. Shows how the design, the desktop metaphor can really lead design astray when applied to portable technological devices. This is the Sony MagicLink. I want to talk about, I'll sit on the slide for a little bit so it can sink in. You probably saw it as a blip on your radar at some point around 1995. It's running an operating system it's made by Sony. It's running an operating system by a company called appropriately for this talk, General Magic. And General Magic was started by a bunch of Apple people who were trying to take the ideas that they developed with the Macintosh to a new level. They developed an operating system called Magic Cat. The principle was really interesting because it was to couple the idea of portable computers, which were really like just possible, with network communications, which was just emerging. And so that actually makes it a very interesting kind of transitional object. MagicCap, at least in concept, is a really interesting innovative operating system. It uses compiled bytecode, later to be used by Java, in a language called Telescript, which was designed for developing intelligent agent systems. Little agents would run around and get stuff for you while you were doing something else. Unfortunately, the company was not particularly successful, and very little software was written for it, so it just kind of got it. From a UI standpoint, MagicCap is also interesting. General Magic, understanding that these devices were different than desktop computers, tried to create an interaction metaphor, I'm sorry, I'm reading this literally, that could encompass the power of portable network devices. The way that they decided to do it was to leverage off of their experience at Apple creating the desktop metaphor and extend that metaphor. And let's see what happened when they did that. This is what happened. This is the MagicCap desktop. So unlike previous desktops, and we already saw like what desktops looked like in 95, this one looks like a desk. Why is that? Isn't that kind of like going backwards? They actually had a very sound reason for it. I actually don't know any of them personally, but as far as I can figure out, I believe that what they wanted to do is to make it clear that because you were now no longer confined to a desk by the device physically, you didn't necessarily have to be confined to the desktop in the interface. And so just like the device could physically leave your desk, in the interface, you would go out in the hallway. And see, there's your desk that's on the left, and there's the library, and it says up in the upper left-hand corner that we're in the hallway. And here's where you can start to see the problem of sticking too close to a metaphor where it's no longer really applicable. We're using an operating system. We're trying to get things done, but now we're in a maze of passages all alike. So what happens when you go right? So what happens is, well, you go further down the hallway. Now there aren't actually even labels on any of this stuff other than the thing in the middle. And why is it? What is the screen for? Well, it's for continuing the metaphor. Because if you have a hallway, there should be at least two ends to it. They had to create another end to it. So what happens when you enter the room? Like, let's say, a game room. It's kind of empty. And it's actually starting to get, the clock is starting to get scary, so we should probably get out of here. Okay, so now we're back in the hallway. So where else can we go? Oh, look, in the upper right-hand corner it says we can go downtown. Well, now what does that mean? Oh, right, we leave the house and we go downtown. So you can see our house is on the left, there's a directory in the middle, and look, what's on the right? It's the internet. So if you continue into the internet, you may find a diner. If you go into the diner, you get to see the diner. And see, in the middle, there's a poster that says explore the web, and there's some donuts. I'm actually not sure what happens when you click on the donuts. Now, I don't want to criticize the general management folks too much. They were doing this more than 10 years ago. This is, you know, they're probably designing in 93, 94. And it's always easier to mock something in retrospect. What's interesting is that if you extend the desktop metaphor into this kind of quasi-virtual space as a way of extending it to portable devices, which is what they were trying to do, it's grossly inappropriate. And how am I, Sony customer and business person, you saw that first shot with the guy with the nice cell phones, supposed to do any work with this thing? And why I'm bringing this up, why I went in depth about this, which was kind of the end of the logical conclusion of the desktop metaphor taken to portable devices, is because this pattern is interestingly starting to repeat. Let's take a look. That's a phone. That's a phone from the late 90s. It's essentially this. That is Windows Mobile today. It's essentially this. And so we may have avoided now the literalist mistake, because you don't see that much of the kind of stuff that General Magic was doing. We're still stuck with a metaphor that treats any kind of computer as a mini desktop. The ultimate goal that everyone seems to think is to want to put a desktop on anything that's got a screen. But that's actually not where computers are going, if you stand back. That is Mark Weiser, the late Mark Weiser of Xerox PARC, who coined the term ubiquitous computing and the original framer of the ideas behind Ubicon. His quote is that ubiquitous computing is roughly the opposite of virtual reality, which I really agree with. It's not creating virtual objects. It's using the technologies that allow you to do that in real objects. I define it as the practice of embedding computation into special purpose objects rather than trying to simulate them in a general purpose computing environment. To me, ubiquitous computing means treating information as a material. So it's sort of like plastic or bamboo or chrome. It changes the fundamental capabilities of the object you're designing with in the same way that making something out of rubber is different than making it out of plastic. I also believe that ubiquitous computing holds amazing promise for making the world a better and more interesting place. Mobile phones are just the first example of Ubicon, but interacting with them is really mostly terrible. Their interfaces across the board are kind of invisible in many ways. If we're to make full use of the capabilities of these technologies, of all the stuff that I mentioned, we must develop new ways of thinking about the possibilities of technology beyond the old design frameworks. I propose magic as a new metaphor for user experience design of ubiquitous objects. And let me say up front what I'm talking about. I'm not saying we should try to create actual magic. And I'm not saying that we should pretend the technological objects are somehow magical. I just feel that magic is a good framework for talking about how to design Ubicon objects, so that we are not starting from scratch for every object, and we're not reinventing the wheel from an interaction perspective. So what I'm proposing is a metaphorical relationship between magic and portable network-aware information processing objects, which is analogous to the relationship between office supplies and computer screens in the desktop network. This will, I hope, allow us to imagine complex interactions without requiring us to explain basic ideas every time. It gives us a vocabulary and a set of examples that describe relationships between people and objects without being tied to technological details. Let me define also what I mean by magic. I don't mean augury, telepathy, rainmaking, clairvoyance, necromancy, demonic possession, or transmutation. I'm not talking Dungeons and Dragons. I'm not talking Magic the Gathering. I'm not talking the Bride with White Hair. I'm not talking World of Warcraft. In fact, I don't mean the vast majority of magical concepts that exist in every culture. I mean enchanted objects. Why enchantment? It's a widespread metaphor about object behavior. Ubiquitous computing objects use information processing, wireless networking, sensors, actuators, displays to engage with behaviors with the world. Explicitly not on a screen, it's with the world. What differentiates them with other kinds of objects we meet in everyday life is the fact that they actually have behaviors. Now, normal objects normally don't do anything unless explicitly commanded. But ubiquitous computing objects, smart objects, can have behaviors independent of immediate commands. That's what differentiates a ubiquitous computing object, say, from a shovel. And that's unique to the history of people's relationship to non-living things. So things before this never had behaviors. They never had their own independent behavior before ubiquitous computing objects. Magic allows us to talk about how all these pieces that make up ubiquitous computing can fit together from a user's perspective. Not from the system view, but from the user view. And there are a number of properties they have that allow that allow for them. Let me enumerate some of them. They are, or they can be, or traditionally are, everyday objects. Enchanted objects are everyday objects. They have, because of this, they have familiar interactions. They are physical, namely, but they are not virtual objects that appear on a screen, or physical manifestations of these abstract information objects that we these days. You know, we see a lot of, I think, MP3s, MP3 players are a kind of physical manifestation of a virtual object. They have a physical use mode because of this that's built in. You don't have to teach a person to point a wand or to wave at something. You don't have to tell them where a ring goes, well, you know, most rings. The magical objects don't have screens. They are not. Magical objects are also not human, and we don't expect them to act human. We don't expect enchanted objects to be like human. We don't expect them to be like robots, like humanoid robots. We expect them to be these things that have a special quality about them. They're not superhuman. In other words, they may be sometimes hard to control, as Mickey found out with that famous scene with the moths. But ultimately, it's we who are controlling, not them, they, by definition. They're not as superiors, which makes which a lot of user experience design doesn't always create with interactions. Okay. All right. I'm going to speak more into the microphone. Thank you. And finally, there is a healthy disbelief in magic. So it's already going to be treated as metaphorical. Concepts like ambient intelligence, which is what Ubicom is called in Europe, are much more ambiguous. I mean, do you really mean intelligence? Intelligence like I'm intelligent? Magic is is already set aside metaphorically in most cultures as this special thing that you kind of believe in at best, for the most part. More importantly, I think kind of most importantly, many of today's technological objects that are of a ubiquitous computing nature are already tapping into the magic metaphor. Sometimes more closely than others. But let me show you. This is the ambient orb from Ambient Devices on your right. It's probably no accident it looks like a crystal ball. It's an ambient information display device. And it is essentially tapping into the visual and physical resonance that particular shape and function has in order to create a user experience that is familiar. You kind of know what the thing does based on your cultural background, seeing other things that are magical that present and display information this way. So when you see one, it is unfamiliar, but it is not totally alien. Let's continue. The Rocket eBook, which was the first eBook, it's a kind of magic book with one page. It kind of looks like a book. It intentionally looks like a book. And it looked, and it was explicitly designed to not look like a laptop, and to explicitly kind of look like a one-page book. Let's continue on. This is the Summary Eye of Judgment card game on the right. It's a card game that's kind of like Magic the Gathering, but in addition to just kind of putting your cards down, if you have a camera that's on your PS2 and it uses image recognition, it makes your cards come alive. So you have a battle with your on screen with your opponent's images by gesturing over your own. So switch over the card that is going to shoot a fireball at your opponent's cards, and on screen it shoots a fireball at your opponent's avatar on screen that is floating over their cards. You move your cards around, the avatars move around. You gesture over them differently, they do different things. This is a concept that came around earlier this month. It's actually the only thing here that's not a shipping product. It's a concept for a memory ring that heats up one day out of the year to remind you of an anniversary. So it's the one ring. This is the Nokia Medallion, which came out about 3 years ago. It lets you upload pictures from your phone to the medallion, which then scrolls through the images as you're walking around. They weren't all that successful, but this is from a patent that Sony filed for a game controller. It's clearly wand-based for PS2. The Wii controller is, for the Nintendo Wii controller, certainly also a wand. And can be used in very wandy ways. You can swing it around, you can point it, you can press on it. There are other kinds of wands that exist that you're familiar with already. This is the Hitachi Magic Wand. And you're probably familiar with this wand also. So these things already exist and are already out there. And in fact, all of them are using the word magic wand to describe what it is they're doing. Here's a particularly interesting piece of technology. It came across the Gizmo Box a couple months ago. It's a Japanese USB lodestone. So you put pictures of things that you lost in it and swing it, and it will swing the direction that the thing is. So it works really kind of about as well as Jack Sparrow's compass in Pirates of the Caribbean, which is supposed to find the thing you're most looking for. And I explicitly use this thing as opposed to GPS receivers, because GPS receivers are actually magic compasses. But this thing it takes it one level further and really tries to invoke the magical aspect of what it is that it's doing. Finally, we have Enchanted Animals. The Navaztec is a responsive ambient display device, but it's also an explicit personification of data. It can react to data. The new one has an RFID reader in its nose, so it can sniff your RFID tags. It has a speaker or a microphone that's a bell button, so it can hear the ambient noises and react to them. It becomes this reactive creature that is essentially displaying data in various ways in your media environment. So, in conclusion, the age of magic is coming. Chip manufacturers have low-power chip roadmaps, and wireless communication standards are currently congealing, so that there's going to be a lot more objects like this. And I believe we need to systematically approach the user experience design of these devices. And one way that's been shown to be successful 20 years ago is the adoption of a strong metaphor that can be leveraged to explain the functionality of many of the ideas embedded in a new set of technological tools. I believe that magic, as a metaphor, is an incredibly rich idea that can be mined for interesting and familiar user experience design tropes when talking about the design of user of ubiquitous computing. And it would be a mistake to pass up the opportunity to use it at this early stage in the proliferation of these devices and ideas. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Do we have any questions for Mike? Questions?
How does this map onto other cultures that have a different view of magic?
How does this map onto other cultures which have a different view of magic?
Nearly every culture has enchanted objects. The Japanese have kami that exist within everyday objects. Basically, every culture has its version of enchanted objects, as opposed to magic in the sense that we, in the like the large sense that we were talking about, whether like Merlin the magician, of course not every culture has it, but every culture has its magical objects, which are almost always everyday objects. African cultures have everyday mystical objects that also have special powers. I mean, everybody does, Native American cultures. And that, I believe, is a very, very strong vote for why this could work, because it can layer on top of those already existing cultural experiences and assumptions people have.
Other questions?
Yeah,
Can
you talk a little bit about the desktop metaphor has, other things like folders, files, that kind of thing. Can you talk about the vocabulary for magic? All I really heard.
Well, so the question is, the desktop metaphor has things within the metaphor that are like folders and files and things like that, trash cans. What's a vocabulary for magic objects? The list of things that I was just showing you kind of is at least my start at a vocabulary. Vocabulary, things like wands, things like the Adidas one shoe, shoes, so suddenly boots, right? You know, that concept. There are enchanted, you can have enchanted blocks, you can have all kinds of things. So I think the vocabulary already kind of exists in the form of the objects themselves, and that list of the very common ones, I think, shows a start.
Okay, one more question?
Where is the enchanted forest?
It's in Oregon.
In
Hillsboro? No, sadly, it's not in Hillsboro.
In
Actually,
Mike, I have one question myself. Mark Weiser had, for example, he had a fountain that was spelled differently according to the Xerox stock price. If you know the magic of this, you know that this enchanted object is in fact telling you something, but if you don't, it's just a thing. So in the future, when my enchanted toilet brush is vibrating, what does that mean? Going to this, back to this vocabulary, how do you get the affordances of these enchanted things?
I think that's a very good question. I mean, within mythology, at least within Western mythology, there is also this history of people getting enchanted objects and not knowing how to use them. And part of magic is learning how to use the objects you have. So there may already be an expectation for how to use these things. And so you have a base level. Like the Nabaskai actually is pretty good about this. Like there's a very base level at which you can use the magic, or the ambient orb. You know, it'll display a set of pre-selected things for you. But then you can start, you realize that, oh, can we act to these other things? And you kind of delve deeper and deeper. And sure, I mean, you do it by, you know, going and finding the magic manual that tells you about, you know, the magic other affordances that are there. Right. That's
great, thank you.
Yep.
Okay, we're gonna take a 10-minute break. Thank you very much. Okay, we'll be back with Tim Humpkin as soon as we get the projector happy. Thank you very much.
Drink up.
Be nice to your bartender, Mommy. Thank you.
Okay. So there's...
Okay, ladies, gentlemen, dorks, everybody, we are ready to start the next part of the show. There are still a few seats up in front. I am your MC, your master, Lord John Wood. We can keep it down and we will start the next presentation. Thank you very much. Yes.
Nobody heard you in the back.
Okay, let me turn it up a little bit. Ladies, gentlemen, dorks, we are about to start the next part of the show.
Yay!
Yay. So I think there are one or two seats up here, and our next guest comes to us all the way from the UK. His name is Tim Hunkin. He scarcely needs no introduction when I introduce him anyway. Even though I can't do justice to some of the cool things he's done, he's going to talk about some of them. He's done giant pumpkin, done giant puppets. He has done a television show called The Secret Life of Machines. He's done a number of ingenious and fun things. He's inspired a lot of people. If you were on the desert and you saw the disgusting spectacle, well, that was Tim's idea. Only Tim did it small. He did some very interesting things, all with humor and ingenious approach, and I will turn it over to him. Tim, thank you very much.
Hello, I'm delighted to be here. I sometimes think that San Francisco is my spiritual home. There are not so many people in England who mess about with all this sort of mix of art and technology in England as there are here. I want to talk about my current obsession, which is, in the last 5 years, I rather turned my back on doing jobs for other people and set up my own amusement arcade, which is called the Under the Pier Show, and it's only 4 miles away from where I live, so it's very handy. And I just love it, I'm obsessed by it. Amusement arcades historically have been at the front of technology. 100 years ago, about 100 years ago, it was the first place where many people saw moving pictures, moving images in Edison's kinescopes. And of course in the 80s and early 90s, arcades were in the forefront of arcade games, the best video games you could do and play in arcades rather than at home. And it's a bit sad that they've lost that edge, and I think it's time to reinvent them. So that's why I want to show you my arcade. So if we play the first video, this is my shed on the pier. It's not very big, but it holds enough people, and it's actually very successful. I should say perhaps that I'm now completely financially independent. I live off this place. This is the underwater adventure that you can see people coming out of. It looks as if it might go under the pier, but it doesn't actually. It just wobbles about a bit. And you actually watch a TV screen with a little fish tank in front of it, so you've got bubbles in the water. It's a simple animation that you'll see a bit more of later on. I don't know what's coming up next. So you'll see it wobbling about, that's it. It doesn't have to wobble about very much to feel that you're underwater inside. This has become much more to the current. I made it 10 years ago. And I should say there are extra gloves that shoot out between your legs. This is the dog walking machine, it's called Rent-A-Dog. It's the sort of the human view of a walk versus the dog's view of a walk. So yeah, I'll show you a bit more of that later on. Based on a treadmill from a gym. I think this guy is just winding up a sort of Frankenstein monster who sort of Yeah, it sort of scares him a bit. This is an exercise for couch potatoes. It's a sort of it's a bed that does the exercises for you. So it's got a very good bum wiggling action. What's up next? This one's called instant weight loss, and it sort of pops a single grain of popcorn and then bends a mirror to make you look a lot thinner. So this one is the chiropodist, and you have to take off your shoe and put your foot in the compartment, and she tickles your foot. So just surprisingly loud screams it makes. This is the photo booth, the expressive photo booth. It does things to promote different expressions. I think the photo's just come out there. This one is the instant holiday package. You can go on a complete holiday in 3 minutes. And I think that's the sun lamp that's come on. So you get 30 seconds of suntan in completing this 3 minute holiday package. This one is training for your future. It's called Mobility Masterclass, and it's training you for your old age to be able to cross freeways with a walker. And it's based on a physical model. You can sort of see the model there. So that, I think this is about the end of this introduction. So this is my life these days, really. And as it's grown, every time I make more machine, another machine, I get more money. So the satisfaction is incredible, because I go there and I see people laughing at my handiwork, and then at the end of the week, I go and empty all the money out. And it's cash. I know, it's very hard to think. And I've done other things that have made more money in the past, but it's certainly I prefer this.
How much does it cost to run a ride?
They vary. The bat escape, because it takes a whole family, is £2, and the ones that take one person are £1. And some of the smaller machines are 40p, so it varies. Soaks up all your money one way or another. Very important to have a change machine. It's exciting that, to me, I'm more based on making sort of mechanical contraptions than in the computing world. But it's sort of wonderful that the way things have gone, that you really don't need to be too techie to be able to do this sort of thing. I think I love the idea of just using consumer electronics and doing things as low tech as I possibly can. I've decided to abandon the slides because we were having technical problems, so I'm only going to show you video clips. So the next one, I'm going to show you the holiday, the 3 minute holiday. This one, I should tell you before you begin, was based on a Sega Space Harrier. When I started working with the peer, they started giving me their old arcade machines from the main arcade they threw out. And in a way, that's why I got into all this stuff. They gave me this old Space Harrier with a seat that rocked and tipped. And I was about to just take the motors out, but I thought it was so beautifully made that I just put a bit of plywood on top and connected the motors to two switches. And I thought it was such fun just rocking around. But I put an armchair and a telly on there and thought I ought to be able to make some video to sort of fit. Anyway, this is the result. This is Microbreak.
I'm applied AirB44 to Cosmolente. In the unlikely event of mid-air collision, you will find an emergency exit on your right and another on your left. If you should have to put down in the seat, you will find a life jacket underneath your seat. Tie it on the left with a double bow. Enjoy your flight.
Something to control the motion, a picture for whatever. I prefer programmable logic controllers, but that's just my own taste, always what I'm used to. But it is very low tech. And I think there's so many brilliant short films that get made, and it's very difficult to know for filmmakers to know what to do with them. To me, it's a revelation that you just have to wobble people about a bit while they watch them. And they'll pay you money to watch them. I think all filmmakers should take note, really. But another thing I discovered while doing this arcade, which I sort of knew about myself anyway, was that I have this feeling that most animation is far too slick. When I watch Forrest and Gromit, much though I love them, there's something about watching it that makes me tired to think of all the effort that went into every single frame. And I rather like the idea that you can sort of do things in a more cheeky way and sort of admit that animation isn't perfect and their mistakes. So as you probably realise, that those cars, they're just sort of digital photos, sort of stuck with a bit of lead that I could move along. And so I just, this has become my favourite form of animation, just sort of making physical models, which I was going to show you on slides, but I'll just have to tell you. So I cut lots of pictures of buildings and people and cars and things out and make them into very crude physical models that I can drive my camcorder or my camera through. And I do this largely because I don't want to spend all day at a screen. But it does produce a sort of effect that I rather like. So next I'm going to show you the dog walking machine, because this has got probably my most ambitious bit of this sort of clunky, sort of half-digital animation in it. All right, this is Rent-A-Dog. Not only getting the old arcade machines, I also used to get their gym machines. One of the great things about basing machines on existing machines is that all the health and safety problems have already been largely worked out. So I knew people were going to track themselves and the sides of the treadmill. It's a lot less to think about. Of course, I mean, my arcade, it runs unattended, so I have to be ever so careful. And things also have to be very reliable, and I spend a lot of my time making things safe and making them reliable, which is a sort of engineering challenge, but it's quite dull. If you're just making them for science fairs or something when these machines are going to be attended, you need to be nearly so careful, so you could make them even quicker than I do. So I think they do have enormous potential. It's not high tech in a computer sort of way, but it does add enormously to just adding a little bit of computing power to sort of mechanical things.
Excuse me, could you play Mobility Masterclass for us,
please? I'm just about to do that, actually.
Patience!
The reason, what I was going to say about that one was, well, once I got obsessed by simulator rides, I started to read about their history. And they have a wonderful history. They first appeared for military use, for training pilots, before the days of computers. And so they had quite heavy video cameras that flew over physical model terrain. And some of these models were vast. They were the whole size of complete aircraft hangars. If anybody's got any photos of these early models, please email them to me. I'd love to see them. It's very, because they're military, I find it's hard to get collections of these images. Anyway, it was this idea of seeing physical models, using physical models, that inspired Mobility Masterclass partly. But also the fact that my parents were getting very old and starting to use walkers and things, so it was something I was thinking about a lot. So this is my way of using a camera over a physical model. I think all the time I'm trying to fight the idea of everything being screen-based and just using video. And the fact that it was a real model sort of, I don't know, was something I really wanted to try. And yeah, I think you saw in that introductory video that a thing that I hadn't really thought through but is wonderful is that it enables everybody in a room to sort of join in with the game and cheer the person who's doing it on because everybody else can see the model. Okay.
You have chosen to enter the Mobility Masterclass. Your task is to cross the motorway with the Zimmer-free. Before you start, please watch our safety training presentation. First, choose the age you're training for. The kids should start at 18. Choose now. To use the Zimmer, pull up both brakes to release them. Try it now.
I should say that walkers are called Zimmer frames in England.
Cross one lane for motorway at a time. The bell will ring on successful completion of each lane. You are now fully trained. Try practice.
Thank you.
crossing the next lake. You have completed the practice run. It is now time for your examination. This crossing must be completed without a single crash. If you're feeling confident, you could choose a higher age before you start.
No!
This is what happens when you win.
With the Zimmer frame. First, choose the age you are training for. Beginners should start at 80.
Playing computer games at home more exciting than playing them in arcades has made it possible for all of us to make our own arcades, and it's time to reinvent the arcade. Thank you very much. Is the one you saw in the first video that wobbles around. The video is about 5 minutes long. I think I've probably gone on too long already. But
do you have the videos somewhere on the web?
Well, they're not. The reason I don't put them on the web is that for people who turn up at the arcade, it's much more fun to actually be inside the thing and see them without having, you know, seen it before on the web. So it's not something I sort of push. I mean, I know people in this room are unlikely to go there, but that's why I haven't put it on the
road. Yeah, I'm on a limited income, so I can't afford to go on.
We want
Yeah, well, I am wondering about putting it on YouTube, because then you'd see it on such a small picture, like maybe it wouldn't spoil it so much. I'm not sure.
Kevin, can we watch it now?
Do any people want to watch it now?
Yeah!
I think some of the references may not work here because they're to do with being in England in a sort of posh seaside resort. But I hope you could be bitten, eaten by a big fish anyway, so I guess some of it will work. Okay.
Thank you. even now, we know who our protective shell.
Water drips down on the recording to that point.
And now we say goodbye to this kingdom, freshly regurgitated, and thankful to still be alive.
Suspension of disbelief.
That's right, suspension of disbelief. And my feeling is that's what everyone who deals with these arcade games is actively participating in that activity. They're very willing to accept what you have to show them and adapt to what you have. So I think you just be very flexible in your presentation.
Well, I think it's not just arcade games, is it? I mean, if you've ever tried to put a bit of music to a bit of video you've shot, it always fits perfectly because your brain just makes you, you know, fit whatever it can. So I think things are quite forgiving. You sure notice it when your brain picks it up and you have to get rid of the things that are obviously wrong. But I quite enjoy it if you're sort of kind of semi-aware of the fact that it is really crummy and my brain stays forever and whatever, you know, whatever happens. It's sort of, and like in that one, you know, the fish were just suspended on bits of acetate and sometimes you can see it like that.
More
question
here, yellow.
Could you elaborate more on why you doing 2D on the video, it being so retro, it works so well, and I think the 2D somehow explains why the South Park TV show in America is so popular, because it was taking a step back, and it works so perfectly with what you're trying to do that it's just a perfect fit.
Well, South Park's a bit different because South Park is flat. I'm using 2D in a 3D landscape, which is what I think I'm improving on South Park. Just by, only in the sense that my 2D cars coming towards the camera look bigger from one frame to the next. So it's a sort of it's a way of sort of cheating 3D. Yeah.
One more question.
Considered a traveling version of your show?
Yeah, I have, but it seems like a lot of effort because when people get on a pier, they're in a good mood. They're sort of up for making fools of themselves and they really want to have a good time. And I have a good time mending them. It's a really nice place. It's a bit like having a dog. You know, I have to go there early in the morning or in the evening, and you know, what a great excuse to go down and sort of be walking on water and just thinking, I can't believe that this is actually real and I'm living off this. So I think if I was sort of, to me, the idea of a traveling show seems like a lot of hassle, really. They're awkward, they're heavy machines, you know, I would have to, there's quite a lot of gaffer tape and things inside them to keep them all there, and I think that it would be a lot of work, and it's more fun to get on with the next machine.
Have you ever thought of putting them in a trailer? So
I have thought of things like that, but I think if I was more commercially minded, but I like to have some of my year left for going on jaunts like this, and I do commissions, not so much for the money, but just because I start to feel I'm on my own planet with this arcade, and just to make me feel sort of some connection with what everybody else is doing. I still like to take on a certain number of commissions.
Have you ever thought of hosting a festival or a contest where you invite other people to submit their ideas?
Well, I'm always interested in getting other people involved. I'm working with a new person this summer, which has been really good fun. So I'm always open to things. I like collaborations. A lot of these things, well, as you see at the credits, I do work with other people. And so yes, if you have other ideas or want to collaborate, you're welcome to email them.
What are the hours?
Sorry?
Are you open year-round?
Yeah, we're open all year-round. It's kind of atmospheric in winter. You'll probably have a place to yourself at some most days. But it's always busy on weekends, so it is worth keeping it open. Also, if the machines were, if I switch them off, they would get damp, and so it's better for the machines to keep them running. And I like it in winter. It's sort of kind of wild, and people have a good time. You know, there aren't so many people around.
Have you ever thought of just like selling out and shipping your life's work to Burning Man?
I don't like the heat. This is why I've never been. I love the idea of Burning Man. But I am hoping to get to next year's Makers Fair, which also looked really exciting.
Well, thank you very much for coming.
Where is it located?
Where is it located? It's in. You can find it there. It has a web. I've got a website for it. It's called underthepier.com. It's located, which shows you, which has a map. It's located about 100 miles northeast of London, in East Anglia, a town called Southport. That references to Southport in the last video, which is a very sort of smart seaside resort, which actually is useful for me because the machines don't get vandalised too much. Well, they don't get vandalised at all. And it's famous for the high cost of its beach huts, which is the reason for the references to the different huts.
You should mention Exploratorium.
All right. Oh, yes. The reason I'm here is I'm working at the Exploratorium with Mike Petridge and Karen. We're working on some workshop activities for kids. So, in a way, that answers why I don't want to take it on tour. I like to do other things as well.
Anybody willing to work openly? Any announcements? Anything?
The guy with the back there.
Mark.
Mark, come on up. Okay, while Mark is coming up with a few announcements, there was a donation jar circulating. If no one stole it, please be nice to the donation jar. We can use it. Please be nice to our hosts here at Boca. Be nice to the bar staff. If you need a refreshment, come on up. Who is Open Door to come? What's that? Yeah, okay. A few announcements. Is Simone in the house? I saw her earlier. Simone has a new blog called suicidebox.com. Right? If you know Simone, you can probably expect some excellent bot action on that blog and that website, so check it out. Another announcement, I personally am involved with the John O'Connell High School robotics team. We can use donations. If your company has extra computers that are thrown away, we can use them. If you want to help out, come talk to me. I am John Foote, your MC of Last Resort, by the way. We're set for Open Door. Who's going to open the door? Somebody pointed at someone.
Yeah,
I'll
do it. Do I have a microphone?
Yes.
I just wanted to talk about the jellies that are at the front door. You should try and get some because there's still some left. They're basically like gummy bear quality jellies. Maybe a little different kind of consistency. And I spent this morning figuring out this formula for how to use different kinds of alcohols in with gelatin. So basically, I just want to explain you how to make those jellies. Each alcohol that I used had a different proof. So there's four kinds of alcohols, Fernet, Chartreuse, and then two others, each Chivantun, some Mayan alcohol, and Agave. So basically, all that's in those things is gelatin, water, some sort of alcohol, some sugar, and some glucose. But you have to do some really interesting tricks to the food, to the sugar and glucose. You have to take it up to a certain temperature so that it reaches a certain crystalline structure, and then take it off the heat and then lower it to a different temperature. So you take it up to like 120 Celsius and take it down to 105. Then you add some alcohol, and then you stir in some gelatin, which makes it not vegetarian, because it's sort of the hooves of pigs and horses. That's gelatin. And then you let it cool, you pour it into these little molds. But to get the same consistency for every alcohol type, you have to do this stupid little algorithm, kind of a formula, where you have to figure out the amount of ethanol that's in the alcohol. So the four alcohols I use are Chartreuse, which is 55%, Ex-Ishibantun, which is 30%, Fernet, which is 40%, and Ungape, the Chinese whiskey, which is 48%. And so I just want to talk you through the algorithm that I had to do. So I just kind of figured this out this morning. I figured it out a long time before, but I was going to figure it out again. So maybe I thought I'd share this algorithm with you. So you have to figure out what percentage of the entire recipe's mass, which is 322 grams, is ethanol. And then ethanol is the mass of the liquor. Anyway, so you basically, let's say you have an alcohol like Chartreuse, which is 55%. You basically multiply, well, this is a huge formula. If you're interested, I'll just show it to you. I don't want to walk you through a big math formula, but suffice to say that you have to do things with different kinds of alcohols so that they will affect the gelatin properties of the gelatin. And if anyone's interested in stuff like this, I invite you to sign up for a food hacking lab. We're doing we did a food hacking talk a couple months ago at Dorkbot, and so I'm doing small little labs. Last week we did a blood lab. We did a lot of pork blood, like pork blood ice cream, pork blood meringue, and we also made a vegan pork blood that's just out of like, you know, beet juice, and we have a wiki online. And so if you're interested in doing any of that food stuff, I invite you to come up to the table and sign up our little thing and get on our mailing list for doing some food hacking labs. That's it, thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other dorks in the house? Somebody wants to announce this, and I need to read this. Ross, video showcase featuring Upper Playground's Run Up, Lonnie Lashoon, Doze Reed, Mr. Cartoon, and more. October 25th, Volga, which is right here, Art, 7 p.m., film, and 9 p.m. Featuring event and very special flight launch. Other announcements. All right, that, I guess, brings this...
Wait, can I get one?
One more announcement.
Okay. Yes, sir.
Oh, thank you. Hey, I just wanted to tell you about these little creatures that I've been studying. They're, anyone see SpongeBob? Yeah, okay, a few people. Well, you know plankton? They really are plankton, and I've been studying these things called rotifers, R-O-T-I-F-E-R, and Karen appropriately called them lesbian plankton. They're a species of all female, and they're about four times the diameter of your hair. They live in pond water, and they only last 1 week. They have one baby a day. They clone themselves. It comes on the side of them as an egg, and they use their one foot to get the egg off them, and when they get stressed, they create males whose only purpose is to fuck, because they don't have stomachs. It's full of sperm. This is real life. This is pond life. I'm not kidding. And what they do is they fertilize the eggs and they make this hard cover around them and they can last 100 years. They can dry up and last 100 years until it rains and gets reconstituted. Then they go back to their lesbian lifestyle of having all females. And this is happening in pond water all around you. Amen. Thank you.
Okay, we have one more open board which requires a laptop which may take a couple of seconds to set up. If you want to stick around, stick around. If you want to get a drink, get a drink. Okay, we're just going to take a little break and let the light pop. One more open door. And thank you everyone for coming.